Canaanites that as well can be resolved through various kinds of ocumtas, but as in the story of Ruth, where we end up developing the drusha of Moavi v'lo Moavit, that the prohibition against allowing Moabites to convert does not apply to Moabite women. It's pretty clear that the interpretation is the result of the moral pressure of the experience of Ruth, in this case, the experience of Rahab, rather than a purely abstract interpretation of the verses. In this week's written Siyum Tel Dvar Torah, I approach the question of the relationship between halacha and ethics in a different context. The question of why the permission or obligation to violate Shabbat to save the life of a non-Jew is formulated as Mishum Eva, because of the risk that not violating Shabbat will generate enmity towards Jews with potentially fatal consequences. Right? Why is it framed that way as opposed to simply framing the halacha that saving the lives of non-Jews is Doche Shabbat, pushes aside Shabbat? I cite Dr. Norman Solomon's challenge and insight that even if we grant that Mishum Eva covers every necessary case, right? So we're not worried that the formulation leaves space for a circumstance where one might not save the life of a human being because of Shabbat, right? We solve all the practical problems. We still need to explain why the halacha isn't formulated simply as a claim that human life outweighs Shabbat. I offer an approach based on former Ashkenazi chief rabbi Rav Yisroel Yehuda Unterman and also from Aaron Lichtenstein, in which the rabbis seek to maintain the formal position that no human life outweighs Shabbat, because violating Shabbat is like worshiping idols, and therefore, just like one is obligated to die rather than commit avodah zarah, and one is not allowed, I don't think, to save human life by committing avodah zarah, the same thing should be true of violating Shabbat. But yet, in practice, mandates violating Shabbat to save any human life, Jewish or non-Jewish. Rav Unterman and Rav Lichtenstein's argument works out entirely formally within halacha. Although the motivation for saving Jewish lives may be pragmatic, if we save a Jewish life, then there'll be more Shemirat Shabbat in the world, and the motivation for saving Gentile lives may be ethical, meaning that once we have conceded that even though, in principle, Shabbat should be worth human life, in practice we're going to save Jewish lives on Shabbat, so then maybe we were motivated to ensure that we don't then make a distinction between Jewish and non-Jewish life. My unrealistic initial goal was for that essay to lead to a different approach to the issue of saving non-Jews on Shabbat, that of Rav Chaim David HaLevi, Shud Aseh L'cha Rav, and to a different approach to Rachav and the problem of Lo Techayeh Kol Neshama, namely the approach of the altar of Slobodka in the collection of his Drashot Or HaTzafun. Considerations of length made that impossible. I tried to hold my Divrei Torah to around 1500 words, but I'll try to make lemonade out of that lemon by presenting this audio shiur instead. Also note for those interested that I'll be giving a shiur on the Rachav issue, similar to the chapter in the book, but with some new material, not all of it the altars of Slobodka, this Monday, June 19th, 2023, at 9:30 a.m. at the SAR Tanakh Yom Iyun, co-sponsored by CMTL. My hope remains that these approaches, whether or not one sees them as resolving the issues they directly address, so it's whether you think the Reb Chaim David HaLevi is really the right approach to the Darchei Shalom Mishum Eva issue, and whether you think that the Altar of Slobodka is the right approach to the Rachav issue, that they'll help us consider alternatives to Rav Lichtenstein's assumption or contention that religious obligation is monistic. Here is Reb Chaim David HaLevi in a nutshell, based on Aseh L'cha Rav 9:33. The obligations are framed as mipnei darchei shalom mishum eva only with regard to mamish evil idolaters, right? People who follow an idolatrous religion that seeks to undermine all ethics in addition to all knowledge of God in the world. With regard to all other human beings, they are absolutely straightforward, positive halachic obligations. Not right. You don't need a rationale. They're not legislation made to counter halacha. Right. With regard to everybody else, they are just straight halacha. So Rav Halevi argues that Rav Unterman claims that mipnei eva mishum darchei shalom are in fact straightforward halacha. They're just implementation of standard halachic principles. He says that doesn't sound right. It seems clear that they are in fact legislations against what would otherwise be the law. But then he creates the okimda. That's only true with regard to the mamish evil idolaters, but with regard to everyone else, and he thinks everyone nowadays falls into the category of everyone else, they are in fact, Rav Unterman is right. He's just, right, Rav Unterman is right substantively. He's just wrong interpretationally, that that's not what the Gemara means by that the legislation was made mishum eva or mitnei derechei shalom. Evil idolaters who destroy the world and any possibility of ethics, we would rather wage, frankly, genocidal war on than peace. Although we'd rather they recanted than wage any kind of war. But the caveat is, we would only rather wage that kind of war if such a war would really succeed in wiping evil out. But in practice, it wouldn't. It would lead, right, the only time when it would lead to that, perhaps, is in some kind of messianic future. But we'll see that it seems unnecessary, right, because we live in a world where such idolatry isn't wiped out. So it's possible to do it without war. So that would certainly be preferable if you can accomplish the same end without without violence. So in practice, in such a war would instead lead to our destruction and or to the entrenching of truly terrible behavior imitating our allegedly virtuous war throughout the world. So therefore, we behave ethically even towards those terrible people, mipnei derechei shalom, because it's better for the world for us to treat in the practical reality we live in. It's better for the world if we behave ethically toward even them. Now, this is very different than Rav Unterman's claim that Derechei Shalom and Eva are intrinsically ethical principles and part of halacha. Instead, for Rav Halevi, Derechei Shalom and Mishum Eva are a kind of hora'od sha'ah in a world with genuinely evil idolaters. They're not really ethics because we don't really have ethical obligations towards such people. And they're not really the halakha, because halakha is that you're supposed to be at war, just that halakha is bracketed by the counterproductivity of such a war. And as I say, Rabbi Levi in practice agrees with Rav Unterman, which implies that the war was in fact unnecessary, and all the obligations that the Gemara frames in terms of those principles are binding as both ethics and halakha with regard to today's non-Jews. Now, Rav Unterman, Rav Halevi, Rav Lichtenstein are all writing, I believe. I don't know exactly when Rav Halevi's Tshuva is dated, but I think they're all writing in the mid-60s. Long before them, the author of Slabodka blazed the path in the same direction, but not at all the same path. And I think this path, in addition to being an interesting treatment of our issue, and one that is productive to think about whether or not one agrees with it or finds it congenial, it's also a very interesting introduction to Slabodka Musar in general. So now we're going to move to reading the Or HaTzafun. Chelek Aleph, Omek Chiyuvei HaTorah Aleph. I'm taking all this off Bar Ilan. So he says that the Torah writes, Vayas Avraham Mishteh Gadol B'yom Higamel Et Yitzchak. That's right, that Avraham made a great feast on the day of Yitzchak's weaning, whatever, right? You know, we have the drasha that it's really Yitzchak's bris, whatever it may be. Avraham makes a big party, and Chazal say Rishmul Bar Nachmeni says in Yalkut Yeshua that Avraham made a mishteh gadol, that at that feast all the 31 Canaanite kings that Yeshua would eventually kill were all there, and this is really astonishing, says the altar of Finkel. Why would it honor Avraham to have the people whom there will eventually be an obligation to destroy at his party? And he assumes that the ones at Avraham's party are not still virtuous, and as their successors were killed by Yeshua, he thinks that they are the avatars of the same culture that will deserve wiping out. Avraham should have avoided them. Right, so we could say, he says, that maybe Avraham didn't actually sit with them, right, but he just felt that he had to be polite and invite them. But Chazal seemed to suggest that Avraham genuinely sat with them, drank with them, and the Medrash actually calls them Gedoli Olam, right, that there was actually an element of honor in for Avram and their being present. So how could that be? So here he tells you, Ulam, Mikan shenefesh ha'adam gedolah me'od. From here we learn that the soul of human beings is very great. Utzfunim b'makeha kochot muflaim, and in its depths there are hidden enormous, right, wonderful powers. V'al af kol yiridus sehem shel malachim ela, and despite all the extent to which those kings had descended, ushlilat zechiyotem kivnei adam, where in fact they had lost their human rights. Right, that's right. That's his phrase. Chiyutem kivnei adam, their rights as human beings. Adayin hayal hem erech rav. They still had enormous worth. Chavod gadol nechshav af avi haolam, adam hagadol banakim, imatzam b'michisuto v'shtafutam b'mishnehu. They had so much worth, even though they had forfeited all their human privileges, all their human rights. They still had so much intrinsic worth that it was a great honor for Avraham to be found in their presence, or for them to be found in his presence and to participate in his simcha. We see this, he says, from the story of Rachav Hazona, Shelamarut Shagat, right, who is Bitam Shalotam Amim, right, who is the daughter of those very same nations. Shelamarut Shagam Aleha Nigzar Hatzav Lotechel Kalashama. Even though she is also included within the rubric of the command, do not leave anyone alive, higia, right, which means from his framework that she belongs to people who have forfeited their human rights, including the right to life. Higia la madrigot elyonot meod bechreach ve'emuna, right, she reached enormous heights. I'm not sure what hechreach means there, but certainly in faith. And he quotes the Chazal, which suggests that Rachav was greater than all the Jewish prophets except Moshe Rabbeinu, and in fact she also has descendants of eight prophets among her descendants. Okay, right. So Rachav is really great, and we show the extent of her tshuva for her earlier sins in keeping with the. The motif of what happens when a woman who is a zona, right, assuming that zona means prostitute, who eventually makes amends, right. So Rachav, who achieves great heights in faith and great heights in tshuva, and merits having, right, and transmits these qualities to her descendants, so that they, right, she merits having Nevi'im and Kohanim. Descent from her, important Kohanim, right? So we see how great the human capacities are. She Rachav zu mibenot haknanim, that Rachav, this Canaanite daughter, she yardu lidyotot achronot v'ibdu zchot kiumam, that, right, that reached these depths that forfeited their right to exist. Nonetheless, itgalu bakochot ko gedolim b'hasagot el yonot shelo rak yishlim adargat benoach. Right, so we should acknowledge that the author thinks that Jews are superior, but Rachav converts. So not only does she fulfill all the heights of humanity, she fulfills the heights of being Jewish as well, right, and therefore because right, that just as Rachav had this capacity in her, so that tells you that each of the 31 kings had the same capacities hidden within them, and that's why Avram was honored to have them at his feast. Now he says, "V'nei muflaha d'farb." The thing is wonderful. Shel marut shirachav higia l'hasagot koch kol yonot v'ishlima tatzmal madrigot gedolot k'ela lo batel gam me'aleha or lo techayek kol lahalav lo techayek kol neshama. Nonetheless, he says, all the things that Rachav did not mean that she was not subject to the command Lo Techayek Kol Neshama. The command applies to all children of Canaanites. She is a child of a Canaanite. Nothing she did changed that. She is still subject to Lo Techayek Kol Neshama. And even quotes a medrash, very odd medrash, that the manner or some degree of Yirmiah's prophecy, Yirmiah is a descendant of Rachav, and Yirmiah's mode of delivering unpleasant news to the Jews is a punishment for their keeping Rachav and her family alive. Very, very odd, very ambivalent. But this is, Rav Engel, this is an important thing, that lo techeya kol neshama still applies, and therefore there can be a punishment for not fulfilling it. But now, does that mean they were wrong to not fulfill it? Here's what he says. Yesh l'tzayin, we have to point out, shebnei Yisrael hayu mechuyavim lenehog kach im Rachav, that the Jews were obligated to behave thus with Rachav. Mitoch hakarata tova, shehazta lehem b'zeh, right, because out of gratitude for what she did in saving the spies and risking her own life to save them from their pursuers, save the spies from their pursuers, and thereby enabling the conquest of Yericho. And we see later, he says in Sefer Shoftim, that the Jews also express gratitude and therefore save another Canaanite man and his family, and right, who assists it to a much lesser extent in the conquest of the city of Luz, and he goes off and founds a city which the Malach HaMavis is unable to enter. He says, "Ulamze." However, this "Rak Nogea Legabe Hakarata Tov Mitzad Yisrael." This only affects the gratitude, the obligation of gratitude from the perspective of the Jews. Shechayavim hayu lenhog ba kemo shenhagu. They had an obligation to behave towards her as they did. Avol b'mashenu geya l'rachav, adayin hayem utal l'gabah hatzav hachareim tachrimeim. But with regard to what applied to Rachav, she still is subject to the obligation, do not keep anyone alive. And then he says a line which I think, to some extent, detracts from the from his point. You can decide that for yourselves. He says that Bnei Israel nonetheless are indicted for arriving in a situation at a situation where those obligations conflict. I'm not sure that I at all agree with him. My book, I very strongly disagree with the notion that Bnei Israel did something wrong, unless he means, even if he means it in a deeper sense, that had they been themselves meritful, they would not have needed her assistance. I think it weakens the point, and so I'm going to bracket that, but acknowledge that it's that here my analysis to some degree is going to depart from Rav Finkel's. Rav Finkel says that the Jews have an obligation to treat Rachav with gratitude and to keep her alive, but she is still, right, if we get tempted to say it in brisker terms, right, that as a gavra, the Jews have an obligation to treat her this way, but as a chefza, she is a chefza. Now he doesn't tell us where the obligation of Hakarat HaTov comes from, but it sounds right throughout like that this is a right, this is an ethical obligation. You're required to respond to chesed to with chesed, and that comes against a halachic obligation lo techeya kol neshama, and it doesn't. It's not a question for him. I think he doesn't even raise the technicality of the shvuah, right, of Rachav taking and taking an oath. He doesn't distinguish between Rachav and her family. He says simply that it's obvious that their obligation is to treat her in this way, but that doesn't change the fact that she is still subject to the prohibition. Rav Finkel at this point, and really throughout, I guess, is not so interested intrinsically in the question of the relationship between halakha and ethics. He goes off now to say that really all of us are like Rachav and the Canaanite kings, that we have enormous potential and our right to live is really only maintained if we fulfill our potential. So all of us are really in the position of Rachav. That's not my interest right now, although it has deep interest per se. And you can understand for yourself, the power and challenges of an approach to human beings that, on the one hand, demands expects so much of them, and on the other hand, demands so much of them. But what's interesting for me, though, is his willingness this way to say that the halakha represents, an abstract moral claim about the condition of a human being, but the obligation is framed entirely by first ethics. when even if there is a person whom you have a halachic obligation to kill, but you have a moral obligation to show gratitude, the moral obligation to show gratitude takes precedence. Now, I don't know if he would necessarily make that an absolute principle that ultimately ethics derive ethics override halakha. I doubt it very, very much. But I think he opens the possibility that really there are two different kinds of obligations. You can frame it in brisker terms, right? There are the obligations that relate to the intrinsic rights of human beings, and then there are then there are obligations, ethics, which relate to the obligations toward human beings. I don't have a broader frame, really, or like convincing abstract frame to put it in. I just want to claim that it seems to me that the Alter is perfectly comfortable with there being two kinds of religious obligations. In this particular case, the resolution to them is to put the formal halachic obligation in the realm of a philosophic position without any practical ramifications. That is not dissimilar from my understanding in the written article that Chazal sought to maintain the abstract position that one has to give up one's life rather than violate Shabbat, while in practice saying that one should always save a life rather than violate Shabbat. But he's certainly comfortable with the notion that there are two kinds of obligation, and that religiously one is supposed to be conscious of these two kinds of obligations. And there will be various algorithms, not necessarily halachic algorithms, for figuring out which one, which type of obligation governs one's practice in the particular moment. I don't know that I buy his particular version. Obviously, there will end up trying, there will end up being necessary constraints on just the claim you always act on what you perceive as your own ethical obligation, regardless of halacha. But the notion that religious obligation is not necessarily monistic, and that he's comfortable with that, I think, is a valuable thing to derive from here. Okay, thank you for listening.